Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Recent news about the COVID-19 pandemic has been slightly better, showing improvements across a number of domains. Both nationally and locally, the number of new cases has slowed, right along with the associated hospitalizations and deaths we've seen with SARS coronavirus 2. Is this attributable to the new vaccines, a function of time, or a combination of both? To address questions like this, along with many others about the virus and the vaccines, we talk today with Dr. Stan Schwartz, a longtime Tulsan who's board certified in infectious diseases. For many years, Dr. Schwartz was the medical director for the Warren Clinic here in Tulsa, and he also served as the hospital epidemiologist at St. Francis. Stan Schwartz is chief medical officer and co-founder of Zero, a digital health enterprise that directly connects employers and providers across the United States in an effort to both improve quality and lower healthcare costs. He also organized and leads Well OK Incorporated, the Northeastern Oklahoma Business Coalition on Health, a not-for-profit organization dedicated to improving the value of healthcare for covered members of Oklahoma businesses. In that capacity, he gave a recent talk, which was featured in an article in the Tulsa World, about something called long-haul COVID, the notion that some percentage of those who contract COVID have long-term symptoms well beyond the usual cycle of illness. Stan Schwartz, infectious disease doctor, health quality expert, and entrepreneur, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Stanley Schwartz, welcome back to Medical Monday. Let's start really basic and just have you tell us what COVID is, the illness, and how is it different, for example, from the flu? I think early on we heard a lot of people kind of poo-pooing the novel coronavirus saying, oh, it's like the flu or a cold. It's really not. Tell us how it's different.
It is really different for several reasons. First of all, it's called the novel coronavirus. You know, coronaviruses have been around for a long time. Some of them can cause colds and various other human infections. But this virus has apparently undergone enough mutations that it has become what we call a novel coronavirus. And by novel, it means that as a population, we have virtually no experience with it. So a huge number of humans on planet Earth, when this first started spreading, had basically no immunity to it. Most of us have some degree of immunity to many viruses that we've had or viruses that are similar to what we've had before. But in this case, many of us were totally unprotected. The other thing of interest is that unlike the flu, it seems to be a little bit more contagious from person to person, spreads more easily. And the other thing is, unlike the flu, it tends to spread more systemically in your body. In other words, rather than just being a lung and a throat and a bronchial tube infection, this tends to have an effect on your internal organs, your heart, your lungs, your pancreas, your kidneys, and so forth. So I think the term novel really is a very appropriate moniker for this virus because it really is different from anything we've experienced in the past.
So you gave a recent news conference for one of your organizations, one of the organizations you work with, and there was a nice article about it in the Tulsa World, and it was specifically about this idea known as long-haul COVID. And what you just said about how the novel coronavirus affects other organs is something that seems to play a role in this long-haul COVID. What's the idea behind long-haul COVID, and do we have ways to know when coronavirus is going to affect more than just, say, the lungs or throat, or, you know, cause like the sort of constitutional symptoms like fever and affect the kidneys or the heart? I mean, how can we frame something like that?
COVID has a couple of interesting effects on the human body, and it's more than just the infection itself. You know, the initial infection occurs in your respiratory tract, your nose, your throat, your bronchial tubes. And very much like a cold, one interesting thing that COVID causes is loss of smell and taste. You know, most of your, what we call taste is really comes from your nose. You inhale the aromas of your food as well as taste them. And the coronavirus damages the nerve endings that are in the inside of the nose that control your sense of taste and sense of smell. So that's one real difference between coronavirus. The second is the coronavirus tends to provoke in some people a very, very overwhelming immune response. In other words, your body, after you get the infection starts, your immune system kicks up, and in some people it kicks up in overdrive, and it sends out all kinds of chemicals, like called cytokines and white blood cells, to help fight the infection. But the battle is so pitched between your white blood cells and these chemicals in your bloodstream that it starts to actually attack your internal organs, mainly through the blood vessels. That's one reason why one of the unusual complications of COVID that we don't see with flu, for example, are clots in very large blood vessels, either in the veins, in the lungs, or even in the arteries in young people that go to the brain. So we've seen strokes in people. Young people have no other reason to have strokes. So the thing that's novel about COVID is not just that we don't have a good immune reaction to it, but when our immune system does kick in, it may go way into overdrive. And that's what frequently tips people over 10, 14, 16 days into the infection. They suddenly get worse. Their lungs start to fail. Their kidneys may fail. That, in part, is due to that overwhelming immune system response. And that's one of the reasons doctors figured out that at that point in time, giving large doses of steroids, which suppress the immune system, may actually be beneficial.
So is it key to give steroids right at that time, or do you try to get them on board sooner, or you don't want to do that because of the potential side effects if they're not going to tip over into that more inflammatory state?
Yeah, that was exactly what we talked about on a press conference this week. Steroids are only indicated in the late stages when the infection part's dying down, but the what we call the inflammatory reaction, that over-exuberant immune reaction, starts. So steroids given too early, like if you go to see the doctor with mild COVID, the steroids can actually be harmful at that point. But given late, when a person is quite ill, you know, when they're just starting to lose their ability to bring oxygen into their system and get into a lung failure situation, those steroids can be life-saving. It's a real balance right now. You know, for example, those monoclonal antibodies that you hear about, you know, not everybody needs them, but you got to get them before you get really sick. So doctors really have a chore ahead of themselves to figure out who is going to be that person that's going to get really sick. I've got to give these medications to them before that happens. And that's not always easy to do.
And Stan, is it the people who wind up getting really sick that wind up with long-haul COVID, or are there some that have milder illness that recover sort of on a more routine or quick time frame, but then wind up with long-haul symptoms?
Clearly, right now, and let me preface everything I say for the next half hour that we talk about COVID, that everything I say may be proved wrong next week or the week after. As we've learned since the beginning of this pandemic, our learning about this changes from week to week as we get more knowledge. But right now, it appears that people that get more severe COVID are more likely to have long haul. Now, there's two reasons for that. First of all, it doesn't matter why you're in an intensive care unit for 2 or 3 weeks, basically in a medical coma, a tube in your throat, receiving mechanical ventilation through a machine. No matter what reason you have to have that, you're going to have a long recovery. It's going to take you weeks to get better from that, just from the muscle mass loss, from prolonged bed rest. You know, everything changes in the body with long bed rest. So people who get very sick may be sick and have a recovery and even need rehabilitation to gain muscle strength. You know, that may easily go on a month or two or three. Then there are also people who get COVID. They don't get a very severe infection, but they don't recover on schedule. We expect most people to be, you know, unless you've had a really bad intensive care unit experience, we expect you to be better within a month. But we're seeing people that go on 2, 3, 4 months. And these are the folks we're calling long COVID. The reason for it isn't clear. And right now, if you see a doctor because of long COVID, the doc has two chores. One is to determine if your long COVID is just a consequence of the infection, or is it due to some kind of internal organ damage? For example, patients that, you know, wind up in the hospital with COVID will frequently have very sensitive blood tests or scans that show that the heart muscle itself is inflamed, what we call myocarditis. Those folks need to be very careful about resuming strenuous activities afterwards because they may actually have some degree of heart damage. So, for example, you know, if you come to the doctor because you've got long COVID and you've been in the hospital and there was any evidence of any kind of heart problem while you were there, even just limited to just showing up on very sensitive blood tests. The doc may want to put you through a cardiology evaluation to be sure that your fatigue is not due to poor function of the heart. And then there are people that get COVID and just don't get better for weeks to months afterwards. They continue to have fatigue, difficulty concentrating, which we call brain fog. They may have muscle aches, difficulty with sleep, generalized aching, feel like they have a low-grade temperature. And that's something that we've seen over the years with after many viral infections. And there's another condition we call chronic fatigue syndrome, which is thought to be the result possibly of a viral infection, where people go on to develop sometimes debilitating fatigue for no reason that can be detected by standard tests.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Stan Schwartz, who is a specialist in infectious diseases. He's also co-founder and chief medical officer of Zero, a digital health enterprise. And we're talking about the COVID-19 pandemic, long-haul COVID. We're going to talk about COVID vaccine. And Stan, we're talking about long-haul COVID, and you helped us, gave us a picture of the fact that someone who even has mild illness could wind up with end organ damage, like in their heart. You mentioned inflammation of the heart muscle, myocarditis, or brain fog, and this can last a long time. And I recognize that long-haul COVID is being described kind of as we speak, as we record this, and you pointed out that the science is changing so rapidly. Do we have an approximation on the percentage of people infected or who get COVID who wind up so far with long-haul COVID?
That's a difficult question. I can answer it by saying people who have recognized significant COVID infection, probably about 10% of people have symptoms that persist past where we expect them to get better, you know, about the 1 month point. This syndrome is so new and cases are evolving so quickly that it's going to be, we're going to learn a lot more about this in retrospect in another year or two. My estimation is we're going to see a very large number of people who do go on to develop this chronic fatigue-like problem afterwards. I've got a very good friend who practices in North Carolina who runs a clinic for chronic fatigue, and he's told me that his business has really picked up since COVID has been around. And I suspect we're going to see that around the country.
Stan, I want to shift gears and talk about vaccine because it seems to be on the front of many people's minds, if not everybody's. Tell us first, what is novel? We have a novel virus, the novel coronavirus. These vaccines, I'm talking specifically about the ones that have been emergently authorized for use in the United States, the Moderna and the Pfizer BioNTech vaccines. They're novel vaccines. What's new about them? And in layperson's terms, what can you tell us about the mechanisms, how those work?
You know, they are truly interesting vaccines. So keep in mind, when a virus infects you, okay, a virus particle gets picked up by your cells. In the case of COVID, a virus particle gets picked up by cells that lining your respiratory tract. The spikes on the coronavirus attach to a certain, we call, receptor, a place on the surface of these cells, and then the virus gets into the cell. The virus injects its own genetic material into the human cell and causes the human cell to stop functioning like a human cell and start manufacturing more viruses. Those viruses eventually burst out of the cell and start infecting other cells. And this chain reaction goes on and on and on. The virus takes over your own cellular mechanism, your own cellular machinery, to replicate itself. The way we used to do vaccines was to take a virus and inactivate it so it can't multiply in your body and inject it so that your immune system would recognize it and start to build antibodies. Or we would take a component of a virus and inject it into your body and hope that your immune system would recognize it. But these new mRNA viruses are really interesting. They take a section of the genetic material from the virus. It's called messenger RNA. And that messenger RNA is the blueprint not to cause your body to create a whole virus, but to just cause your body to create part of a virus. So this messenger RNA, again, a fragment of genetic code, it's put into what's called a nanoparticle, a tiny particle. It's injected into your system. As soon as it's injected, your immune system cells that are sentinels in your body, they're always on guard for some invader, they will ingest this and carry it to other parts of your body. That little piece of genetic material in the vaccine causes your own cells to start manufacturing not a complete infectious virus, like with a natural infection, but just a certain protein called the spike protein. And that spike protein, then your immune system starts to recognize as foreign, and you develop a really good antibody response to that spike protein. So, when you encounter a real coronavirus that has covered with these spike proteins, they're called, and that gets into your body, your immune system immediately recognizes it. You have antibodies against it. Those antibodies coat the spikes, and the virus can no longer attach to your cells. It's a concept that's been around for a decade, and it's been tried in the past, but it's never met a need for it like it has with the coronavirus. And it gives us the ability to create a vaccine really quickly. And here's the other thing, John. If the virus mutates, all the researchers need to do is take some of the genetic material from the mutated virus, and it's pretty easy to modify this mRNA virus to meet the demand of a mutated strain that your immune system wouldn't otherwise recognize as well.
Yeah, so there's so much in there that's worth asking about. So one thing you alluded to is the fact that this technology or this knowledge had been around for about a decade, which is clearly the reason why we were able to develop vaccine so quickly, because heretofore we'd never developed licensed for use ready effective vaccines in anything under, I think, 7 or 8 years at a minimum. And this was absolutely revolutionary. And I think a lot of people who have vaccine hesitancy are concerned about the vaccine because it was seemingly developed so quickly. But what you've pointed out is as if the template existed and we just needed to find the right protein to plug in to the template to get it to work. And moreover, that it's now this template that can work for other variations. That's one thing. Another thing I want to ask you, because I do get this question a lot. People say, an mRNA, I hear RNA or DNA, that scares me. Is that going to alter my own body's genetic material?
That's a really good question. And, you know, when they first started talking about mRNA vaccines, that was my thought exactly. There's two things about that. First is, when that mRNA gets passed through your cell, it's like a template that works once, okay? It doesn't hang around forever. It's eventually degraded. And once it's used, it's you know, one and done. The second is that the mRNA template, only exists outside the nucleus of your cells. It doesn't get into the nucleus of the human cell where your DNA is. Everything takes place in what's called the cytoplasm, the mitochondria, which are the little factories outside the nucleus of your cells. So it doesn't interact at all with your own DNA. And again, it consists of RNA, which is different from DNA. You know, it's like getting the infection, but you're not getting the complete virus. The other nice thing about it is it depends on RNA, so they don't have to grow huge vats of virus in the laboratory. All they need to do is extract this RNA, and then the RNA itself can be replicated, you know, basically chemically replicated without having to deal with a lot of viruses growing in your laboratory.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Stan Schwartz, an infectious disease doctor. He's also co-founder and chief medical officer of Zero, or as it's known, Zero.Health, the website, a digital health enterprise. And we're talking about the novel coronavirus, the COVID-19 pandemic, and the COVAX, the COVID vaccine. And Stan, you alluded also to something about how the mRNA vaccines, this new technology vaccines, the Moderna and the Pfizer that are used here in the United States, they essentially tell your cellular machinery to create these spike proteins, which primes your immune system to recognize the actual coronavirus spike proteins. But as you pointed out, the novel coronavirus is good at mutating. It's good at changing its genome to kind of try to evade detection by our immune system. And so one of the things that you've also done a press conference about is these variants, as they're known, of the novel coronavirus. We've heard about variants in the UK. We've heard about variants in South Africa. There are many others. Tell us about variants, and I guess what should we be scared of, and when might we want to slightly alter our vaccine to try to meet those challenges?
So we all have experienced viral mutation in the past. So every year you get a flu shot. If the flu virus didn't mutate, you get one flu vaccine and that would be it. The problem is the virus mutates, and with a series of mutations, and it's usually not a single mutation, but with a series of mutations, the virus may change enough in its genetic code that your immune system doesn't recognize it. All biological organisms, whether it's a virus all the way up to a whale, you know, mutate. They just mutate at different rates. Interestingly, the virologists tell us that the COVID virus, coronavirus, doesn't even mutate as fast as influenza does. They expect about 2 mutations a month. And some of the mutations, just like in other organisms, may result in a virus that's incapable of causing infection. So a mutation can be the end of the line for a particular strain of virus. But some mutations, as I said, will change the genetic code enough that our immune system doesn't recognize it. We see now there's 3 main variants. There's the UK strain, there's this Brazilian strain, and the South African strain. The UK strain, as I recall, has about 17 unique mutations that have conferred on it the ability to be more easily transmitted from person to person. The jury is out on whether these viruses are more deadly, but you know, a virus that spreads more easily is going to wind up causing more deaths than a virus that is more deadly to any individual, it turns out, just on a mathematical basis. What it looks like right now, John, is that the vaccines that we get, at least the two, the Pfizer and the Moderna, the mRNA vaccines, probably will keep you from getting very sick or hospitalized if you encounter one of these mutations. And that's what really counts. These efficacy tests that are done are based on whether a person gets sick or not. But what we see is what's currently being recognized on these mutant strains is that even if you get the infection, the previous vaccine will probably give you enough immunity that it won't be anything that'll even require, you know, a hospitalization or any special treatment. But stay tuned. This may change next week.
Okay. I think I want to shift to big picture about the vaccine and just ask you, you know, people are clamoring. I tell people when they ask about this, it's a good problem that more people want the vaccine than are currently able to get it. So what's your assessment of why? I admit we're maybe a little spoiled. I mean, we had this revolutionary new technology come out with a vaccine, and I mean, it literally was like a Christmas miracle. And here we are in February, and you know, we have basically 10% of the population, slightly more of it in Oklahoma, that have had at least one dose. So actually, in some ways, we're doing pretty good. And yet, I hear lots of complaining. Why can't I get my vaccine? Why do I have to wait in line so long? Why are these systems so crazy? And I know that you're not responsible for it, but what wisdom can you share with our listeners about patience being a virtue, or you know, what would you recommend counsel at this point?
Two things. First, let's take the example from Israel, where they have a fantastic vaccination rate. And one of the reasons is they have a national health system. So in the United States, we have a national virus problem, but we have a structure that is state by state by state. And each state has developed their own way of distributing the vaccines. And even within states, for example, in Oklahoma, the tribal nations are on a completely different distribution platform than the non-tribal citizens of Oklahoma. So we're trying to cure a viral problem that's national with 50 different mechanisms of doing it. And look at Kansas City. I mean, does it make a whole lot of sense for Kansas City, Missouri, to have a different way of distributing vaccines in Kansas City, Kansas? It doesn't. I think that we haven't had really enough national guidance. And the second part is, you know, our public health system in this country has always sputtered along being under-resourced. And, you know, when it met COVID, it really demonstrated the weaknesses we have in public health in the U.S.
So bottom line, I'm a physician, you're a physician. I want to be very uniform in our messaging. Get the vaccine, and no matter what it takes, be patient, but sign up if you can at oklahoma.vaccinate.gov, or you know, stay tuned. Public Radio Tulsa will keep you informed of opportunities. And I've heard Dr. Fauci say that you know, come April, pretty much we'll be in phase 4. So pretty much anyone that wants a vaccine will be able to get one. And I don't know, Stan, if you're hearing the same thing or interpret it that way, but at least hopefully by summer, anyone who wants one will be able to get one.
One problem, as I said, we have is I've got a 40-year-old friend who's just got the second vaccine, and I've got an 80-year-old friend who hasn't gotten the second vaccine. So we're not necessarily getting the vaccines in the order in which they should be given. I think that people who are vulnerable, which would be anybody over the age of 65, but especially even younger people who have obesity, hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, chronic lung or liver disease, you know, the risk of vaccine is pretty small compared to the risk that you get when you get COVID. I can understand why someone who's younger, especially, someone in their 20s or younger wants to wait. That I understand it. It'd be nice if we got to herd immunity, which means that, 80% or so of our population was immune. Eventually, viruses die out because they have no place to go. They don't live outside of, hosts. But I certainly understand it, but I encourage people to get the vaccine.
Okay, I think I have one more question, which is, we have heard, and even though the vaccine is now available in a limited fashion, but hopefully will be widely spread available soon, and please do get yours when you have the opportunity, we still, and we know this from 100 years ago, from the great influenza pandemic of 1918, 1919, that the very low-tech things that washing of the hands, wearing a mask, and keeping your physical distance are the mainstays of trying to control an epidemic or a pandemic. Just recently, the CDC has issued brand new masking guidelines, and I know you're going to talk about those soon. I was wondering if you could share those with our listeners today.
Yeah, I would recommend that folks look at, and really Google will just do it for you. Just Google CDC COVID masking, and you'll get to a nice page that shows you what they're talking about. But basically, they're recommending now the use of two masks. You know, we've heard recently that double masking may help, but what they did was pretty nice scientific experiments that showed that the use of a surgical mask, one of those blue masks with the elastics that go around the back of your ears, that is secured to the face in a special way that reduces those gaps on the side. And the diagram shows you how to put little knots in the ear loops and then cover that with a good 3-ply cloth mask. Really reduces the likelihood of a droplet carrying the coronavirus by 95%, reduces the likelihood that droplet's going to get through the mask and get into you. You know, masks, when you're the size of a virus, look like big pieces of Swiss cheese. So you've got to have a number of layers of Swiss cheese so the holes don't line up. And that's the whole principle behind double masking.
That's honestly the best analogy that I've heard. My guest today has been Stan Schwartz, an infectious disease physician. He is also the co-founder and chief medical officer at Zero.Health, a digital health enterprise that is focused on healthcare quality and value. And we've been talking today about the novel coronavirus and the COVID-19 pandemic. Stan Schwartz, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity, John.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.